unique and flawless user experience. As proof of this never-ending obsession, he set up a toll-free telephone line where Nintendo game counselors were available all day to help players get through difficult levels. And he initiated the Nintendo Fun Club, which sent a free newsletter to any customer who had sent in a warranty card. Both programs were very costly and could have been offset by charging small fees or obtaining sponsorship, but Arakawa believed that doing so would compromise Nintendo's mission. And to further safeguard Nintendo from the dangers of impurity, he and his team put into place a series of controversial measures. 1. The Nintendo Seal of Quality. Ron Judy had the novel idea of mandating that all games pass a stringent series of tests to be deemed Nintendo-worthy, ensuring high-caliber product and making software developers beholden to Nintendo's approval. 2. Third-party licensing program. Howard Lincoln's strict licensing agreement enabled software designers to make games for the NES, but restricted the quantity they can make, 5 titles per year, required full payment up front, months before revenue from a game would be seen, and charged a hefty royalty, about 10%. In addition to these stringent terms, all game makers needed to purchase their cartridges directly from Nintendo. This ensured peerless quality, but also allowed NOA to dictate price, schedule, and production allocation, which became a particularly touchy matter during the notorious microchip shortage in May 1988. 3. Inventory management. Heeding Sam Borofsky's suggestion, Peter Main devised an incredibly rigid distribution strategy that purposefully provided licensees and retailers with only a fraction of the products they requested. The goal of this technique was twofold: to create a frenzy for whatever products were available, and to protect overeager industry players from themselves. Though NOA's methods drew ire from retailers, anger from software developers, and eventually allegations of antitrust violations from the U.S. government, there was no denying that whatever Nintendo was doing was working. So well, in fact, that Peter Main needed additional reinforcements as he inflicted Nintendo mania on his adopted homeland. 8. Nintendo Power. Help came in the form of Bill White, a straight-laced marketing whiz whose smallish eyes and oversized round-rimmed glasses emitted an eternally boyish vibe. Though he was only 30 years old, and after a haircut could have passed for 13, he spoke about brand recognition, market analysis, and strategic alliances with the expertise of someone twice his age. Part of that precocious nature was due to an almost religious belief in the power of marketing, part was due to his father's history as a Madison Avenue ad man, and part was due to a chronic insecurity that could only be quieted by winning at everything he did. Peter Main saw the potential in White, and hired him in April 1988 to become Nintendo's first director of advertising and public relations. When White joined NOA, the marketing department consisted of just 3 people: himself, Main, and Gail Tilden, an exceptionally smart brunette with an encyclopedic memory. The lack of manpower forced White to wear many hats: commercial producer, press secretary, Peter Main's whipping boy. But his most important responsibility was to forge corporate partnerships. Though Nintendo continued to take the video game world by storm, the rest of the world still didn't know what a Nintendo was. To build the brand, White courted Fortune 500 companies, resulting in pivotal promotions like Pepsi placing a Nintendo ad on over 2 billion cans of soda, and Tide featuring Mario on the detergent maker's giant in-store displays. His coup came with the release of Super Mario 3, when he negotiated for McDonald's to not only make a Mario-themed Happy Meal, but also produce a series of commercials centered around the game. By virtue of his efforts, White became Main's right-hand man, something of a protege. But as Main fed White's ambitions and the young marketer swallowed up more and more responsibility, this left Tilden, the other member of the marketing equation, with less and less to do. This displeased Arakawa, who set out to find a better way to utilize one of NOA's most dynamic employees. If Bill White wore many hats, then Gail Tilden owned the hat shop. Tilden had joined the company in July 1983, back when the video game fad was supposed to be on its very last legs. As Nintendo of America's ad manager, working under Ron Judy and Bruce Lowry, she had to find new and exciting ways to promote Nintendo's latest arcade games. Her creativity, resourcefulness, and nothing is beneath me attitude impressed Arakawa, who later entrusted her to handle the marketing for New York's test launch. She spent the summer living in the city, hiring an ad agency, picking a PR firm, and introducing the paradigm-shifting Now You're Playing with Power campaign with Nintendo's very first commercials. After shepherding the company through its formative years, she was disheartened to see her voice diminished, but didn't see any logical way to raise the volume back up. So when she became pregnant with her first child in 1987, she began to consider converting her maternity leave into a permanent one. Arakawa, however, didn't want to see her go. He had seen what Tilden could do and how quickly she could do it. But as much as she appreciated his desire to keep her there, the situation was what it was, and it wasn't likely to change. Nevertheless, Arakawa continued to brainstorm after her departure, and a couple of months later, finally found a solution. Tilden was at home, nursing her 6-week-old son, when Arakawa called and asked her to come into the office the next day for an important meeting. She was caught off guard, but knew that Arakawa is not the kind of man to ever waste anyone's time. So, the following day, she and the baby headed to NOA headquarters. After dropping off her son with some trusting co-workers, she went into a meeting with Arakawa and some Japanese colleagues from NCL, in which they discussed the possibility of expanding the Nintendo Fun Club's newsletter into something bigger. By 1988, the Nintendo Fun Club had over 1 million members receiving the monthly newsletter, and the company needed to hire over 500 game counselors just to keep up with the more than 150,000 calls per week. The appetite for Nintendo tips, hints, and supplemental information was insatiable. So Arakawa decided that a full-length magazine would be a better way to deliver exactly what his players wanted. Tilden was put in charge of bringing this idea to life. She didn't know much about creating, launching, and distributing a magazine, but, as with everything that had come before, she would figure it out. What she was unlikely to figure out, however, was how to become an inside-and-out expert on Nintendo's games. She played, yes, but she couldn't close her eyes and tell you which bush to burn in The Legend of Zelda, or King Hippo's fatal flaw in Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. For this kind of intel, there was no one better than Nintendo's resident expert gamer, Howard Phillips, an always smiling, freckle-faced video game prodigy. Technically, Phillips was NOA's warehouse manager. He had held that job since February 1981. But along the way, he revealed a preternatural talent for playing, testing, and evaluating games. After earning Arakawa's trust as a tastemaker, he would scour the arcade scene and write detailed assessments that would go to Japan. Sometimes his advice was implemented, sometimes it was ignored. But in the best-case scenarios, he would find something hot, such as the 1982 hit Joust, alert Japan's R&D to it, and watch it result in a similar Nintendo title. In this case, a 1983 Joust-like game called Mario Brothers. As Nintendo grew, Phillips' ill-defined role continued to expand, though he continued to remain the warehouse manager. That all changed, however, when he was selected to be the lieutenant for Tilden's new endeavor. To name something is to make it real, so ideas for the magazine's title were immediately tossed around. The leading candidate was Power Player, inspired by the Now You're Playing with Power slogan. But the trademark had already been taken, and besides, Arakawa wanted the name Nintendo to be used. The brainstorming continued. Nintendo Now? Or maybe Playing with Nintendo? Until they finally settled on one that felt just right. Nintendo Power. From there, Tilden and Phillips began generating column ideas and coming up with sections such as Pack Watch, which provided previews of upcoming games, and Classified Information, which revealed top-secret tips, tricks, and codes. They were pleased with what this was turning into, but agreed that something was missing. A more direct way to connect with their players. A way that said, "We may be making a magazine, but we love these games as much as you do." They couldn't quite figure out how to accomplish this yet, but they didn't have time to chase their tails. They needed to keep moving and define the look, layout, and feel of Nintendo Power. To do so, they flew out to Japan and met with Workhouse, a small design company in Tokyo who could help create a cross-cultural aesthetic that would please the parent company and appeal to kids from every country in the world. Unsurprisingly, it was no cinch to sync up the cultural stylings of East and West. Workhouse liked ostentatious headlines, but Tilden liked understated. She wanted bright, sunny layouts, but they preferred pale, cloudy ones. It was hard to find common ground, but Tilden wouldn't relent. This wasn't about ego. It was about giving kids a reason to run to their mailbox each month and hide a flashlight under the bed so they could stay up late reading under the covers. To diffuse the growing tension, Phillips jokingly suggested that it was no use arguing with Tilden because she was NOA's Dragon Lady. His quip failed to lighten the mood at the time, but the nickname for Tilden stuck. As Phillips was hard at work playing through games in order to rate them for the magazine, the Dragon Lady was struck by the fact that, in a way, Phillips played video games for a living. That was every child's fantasy, wasn't it? At that point, she realized that Phillips was the key to building a bridge between Nintendo and its players. She approached Phillips with this vision, leading them to the creation of a comic strip called Howard and Nestor, which featured a professorial version of Howard Phillips finding subtle ways to give game hints to Nestor, a kid who needed advice but was too much of a know-it-all to ever ask. After fleshing it out, they loved the comic idea but felt it was still missing one thing. The two-dimensional Phillips character needed a telltale trait, something iconic like Superman's S or Popeye's pipe. The answer turned out to be rather easy. At the request of his wife, Phillips always wore a bow tie on special occasions, so it was decided that Cartoon Howard would always wear one as well. In July 1988, Nintendo of America shipped out the first issue of Nintendo Power to the 3.4 million members of the Nintendo Fun Club. Over 30% of the recipients immediately bought an annual subscription, marking the fastest that a magazine had ever reached 1 million paid subscribers. And as the magazine's audience grew, so did the influence of Howard Phillips. If Nintendo Power gave kids a chance to step inside the candy factory, then he was their Willy Wonka, magically and eccentrically showing them how the sweets were made. Though Mario was Nintendo's mascot, Phillips became the face of Nintendo. Peter Main took advantage of this, sending Phillips all over the country for press events and on-camera interviews. This miffed Bill White, who had been working so hard to present Nintendo as a royal kingdom, not the Magic Kingdom. After all, it was Michael Eisner who did Disney's press interviews, not someone in a Mickey Mouse costume. It wasn't that White wanted to stop exploiting Phillips, the guy was pure gold. But they needed some way to present him as Nintendo's jester, and not as the king. Main agreed, and found an elegant solution by turning to the beer industry. Ever since producing its first ale in 1759, Guinness has always appointed a spokesman called the Master of Brew, who supposedly inspects all aspects of the brewing process, from the purchase of barley to the experimental work conducted in the brewery's lab. Following in that tradition, Main appointed Phillips Nintendo's first game master. Shortly thereafter, Howard Phillips became a national celebrity, boasting a Q-score higher than Madonna, Pee Wee Herman, and the Incredible Hulk. The rise of the Game Master was just the latest sign of Nintendo's unprecedented success. By 1990, Nintendo of America had sold nearly 30 million consoles, resulting in an NES in one out of every three homes. Video games are now a $5 billion industry, and Nintendo owned at least 90% of that. The numbers were astounding. But Nintendo's triumph went beyond that. Arakawa had proven that he was more than just the son-in-law. Lincoln had proven that he could take on anyone. And Main had proven that he could swim with the sharks. Although Arakawa, Lincoln, and Main were at the top of the ladder, the unlikely triumph of NOA was a team effort. There was John Sackley, the wild and crazy renegade who fought for every inch of retail space as if his life depended on it. He pioneered the industry's first store within a store by transforming ordinary retail spaces into magical snow globe-like areas called the World of Nintendo. So mesmerizing were these interactive displays that kids couldn't help but fantasize about accidentally getting locked in these stores overnight and staying awake to play Nintendo's games. Sackley also developed the Nintendo Fun Center, a mobile entertainment gaming kiosk that was popular with patients in children's hospitals. Then there was Don Coyner, the man behind Nintendo's happy-go-lucky game-footage-fueled commercials. Previously, he'd been an account director at Foot, Cone, and Belding, where he created the famous slogan for Kraft's macaroni and cheese, "It's the cheesiest." He brought that same gift for innocent, well-crafted cheesiness to Nintendo, overseeing dozens of commercials for games like Dr. Mario and Metroid, as well as other products like Game Boy and the Power Pad. There was also Lance Barr, who designed the iconic look of the NES and the feel of its heaven-in-your-hands controllers. And Don James, the product development guru who helped Barr with the design. James, along with Arakawa, also named Nintendo's pixelated plumber Mario after Mario Segale, the company's mysterious landlord whom nobody had ever met. There were hundreds of others at NOA whose unseen efforts backstage helped to define and then refine the Nintendo experience. Together, they'd single-handedly resurrected an industry, and they did it all with only 8 bits. Imagine what they could do with 16. Chapter 6. The Name of the Game.
"There you are,"
Sega's plucky product manager Madeline Schroeder said as she sidled into the office's tiny kitchen and found Tom Kalinske standing in front of the coffee machine with a cup of Joe in his hand. Although she felt certain that he had heard her exclamation, her new boss did not look up from the papers in his other hand. She thought this odd and rather rude until a split-second forensic analysis of the situation revealed the following. The cup in his hand was empty and upside down, the coffee machine wasn't even turned on, and the dazed look on Kalinske's face was symptomatic of one who'd just seen a ghost. Either Tom Kalinske didn't know how to use a coffee machine, or whatever he was reading had made him catatonic. "My, oh my," Schroeder said, settling upon the ladder. "That must be some compelling literature right there." In a flash, the pale expression on his face became an A-OK smile.
"Oh, hey there, Madeline," Kalinske replied.
He was good like that, with names, only needing to hear them once to remember them forever. "You've probably seen this already, but as you suspected, I found it to be particularly engrossing." He handed her an article that he had been reading as part of his crash course on all things Nintendo. It was a piece written by Anthony Gonzalez that had appeared in the New York Times the previous year, titled "The Games Played for Nintendo Sales." This is what Kalinske had been reading when his coffee cravings suddenly disappeared. Thursday, December 21st, 1989. Seattle. Meet the man behind Nintendo, the video game maker that is the talk of America 3 Christmases running. To his admirers, Peter Main, Vice President of Marketing for Nintendo of America, is a master seller of children's entertainment. They say he is a skilled businessman who has learned lessons from the unhappy history of the video game business and helped revive it into a $3.4 billion industry in only 3 years. To his critics, however, he's an aspiring monopolist, squeezing supply and jacking up prices. Charging monopoly, a competitor has sued, and a congressman has called for a Justice Department investigation. Of all the pieces that Kalinske had recently read about Nintendo, the beginning of this one seemed to perfectly sum up his competitor. They were either heroes or villains, and the truth was entirely a matter of perspective. Unlike other companies obsessed with the facade of political correctness, Nintendo made no effort to hide its obsession with control, the article goes on to say. By design, the company does not fill all of a retailer's order and keeps half or more of its video cartridge library inactive. Nor did the company worry about alienating other developers. But far more in dispute is the company's other tactic, building the hardware system in its games with a special lockout computer chip. When Kalinske first began to investigate what lay at the heart of Nintendo, their controlling, our-way-or-the-highway philosophy scared the hell out of him, mostly because it made sense. Although Nintendo didn't always act with the best bedside manner,
their tactics generally tended to benefit the industry. They had just resurrected the video game business from a terrible crash, and they had taken it upon themselves to put in safeguards to prevent such a thing from happening again. So retailers might complain that orders weren't being filled, or developers might grumble about being locked out, but this was all Nintendo's way of avoiding an Atari-like glut of bad games. Nintendo, in many ways, really did know best. Although this realization had indeed petrified Kalinske, but after he stopped asking himself what the hell he had gotten into, he began to wonder if this might actually be Sega's greatest advantage. Maybe Nintendo really did know best, but if there was one thing Kalinske had learned about consumers throughout his career, it was this. The only thing they valued more than making the right decision was making their own decision. So if Nintendo represented control, Sega would represent freedom. And this cornerstone of choice would be the foundation of Kalinske's plan to reboot, rebuild, and rebrand Sega. He was in the midst of this mini-epiphany when Schroeder entered the kitchen, hence the dazed look on his face. He had seen a ghost, all right. But it wasn't anything malevolent. No, it was the alluring ghost of Sega's Christmas future. "You have to hand it to Nintendo," Schroeder said, finishing the article. "Like them or not, everything those guys touch turns to gold." "You're right," Kalinske replied, turning on the coffee machine. "So I guess we'll just have to make sure everything we touch turns to silver. And you know, while we're doing that, we'll find a way to convince the world that silver is more valuable than gold." "Count me in," Schroeder said, and then smiled, a Cheshire grin through and through. For weeks prior to Kalinske's arrival, she had been hearing how great things would be with him in charge, and how everything would turn around after he took over. At the time, she thought it was just false hope for the hopeless. Now, while that skepticism still persisted, she couldn't deny there was a whole lot more hope. "But enough pontificating," Kalinske said. "I vaguely recall your entering with the words, 'There you are.' So what can I help you with?" "Right," Schroeder said, quickly rewinding her mind. "I had wanted to ask you about your trip to Japan. Was there anything new on the mascot front?"
"I'm not sure, but Nakayama-san assured me that he'd get us a Mario killer sooner rather than later."
Schroeder eyed Kalinske as if trying to somehow conduct a telepathic polygraph test. "And how much do you trust Nakayama's assurances?"
Kalinske thought about this for a moment.
"I'm from the innocent until proven guilty school of thought. I have no reason not to trust him. At this point."
"Okay, just curious," Schroeder said. "Did he at least show you the hedgehog?"
"What hedgehog?"
"That freak from the mascot contest," she said.
Kalinske had no idea what she was talking about, so Schroeder filled him in. Prior to Kalinske's arrival, Sega had held an internal mascot contest, encouraging employees to come up with a new face for the company, which would supplant the current face of the company, Alex Kidd, a disappointing rip-off of Mario. The Japanese programmers submitted a host of diverse entries, including an armadillo, later developed into Mighty the Armadillo, a dog, a cat, a cheetah, a Theodore Roosevelt look-alike in pajamas, and a peppy rabbit that could use his extendable ears to collect objects. The top two choices, however, were an anime-inspired egg and a teal hedgehog with red shoes created by Naoto Oshima that he called Mr. Needlemouse. Nakayama had presented these two finalists to Katz, who quickly declared that they both sucked. He thought the egg was absurd and the hedgehog just didn't make any sense. Nobody even knew what a hedgehog was, so how could anyone ever possibly care about one? Despite the vote of no confidence from Katz, Nakayama forged ahead with Mr. Needlemouse and asked Oshima to explore what kind of game would best suit his character. Oshima partnered up with Yuji Naka, a brilliant hothead in the programming department who was responsible for one of Sega's most popular series, Phantasy Star, a sci-fi role-playing game, RPG, about a resilient young female warrior bent on galactic revenge with the help of a muskrat named Meow and a wizard named Noah. Oshima and Naka worked together to build a game around Sega's new mascot, and it would fall into Schroeder's shoulders to whip the game into shape and introduce it to the world.
"I can't believe the always transparent Nakayama failed to mention all this." "Curious," she said lightheartedly. So, basically, our entire jobs, careers, and livelihoods depend on this hedgehog guy.
Kalinske realized the truth in her words.
Well, I can't think of any animal I'd rather pin my hopes and dreams on than a good old-fashioned hedgehog, he said.
After hedging his way through the hedgehog conversation, Kalinske entered Nilsson's office.
Well, if it isn't Mr. Kalinske,
Nilsson announced as his boss closed the door and sat down on the chair in front of his desk.
Hey, Al, Kalinske said, jumping right in. What the hell is a hedgehog?
You mean aside from the demise of Sega?
Nilsson joked.
According to one Mr. Michael Katz, at least.
He wasn't a fan.
He authored a scathing multi-page letter to Nakayama saying why it wouldn't succeed in the U.S. and other assorted doom and gloom.
Kalinske was taken aback, feeling as if there were trap doors hidden around every corner in this company.
That's a tad disconcerting. Seriously, though, don't worry about it.
Yet, Nilsson reassured him.
We haven't even seen any gameplay, and in this business, it could look like a duck and talk like a duck, but in the end, nobody cares if it's a duck or even a neon green wolverine, as long as it makes for a fun gaming experience.
His words worked, and Kalinske eased up.
Okay, that makes sense.
There's only one thing you need to know to survive in this world.
And what's that?
The name of the game is the game,
Nilsson said, with the bouncy, uplifting rhythm of a prayer worn into the soul by repetition. If Nilsson had known that the originator of the phrase was none other than Nintendo's Peter Mayne, he likely would have washed his mouth out with soap. But with the bliss of quotational ignorance, Nilsson repeated the mantra and then pointed to a copy of Atari's game E.T., which was framed on his wall.
I keep this here as a reminder. Most consider it to be the worst game ever made.
Nilsson pressed his finger up against the glass.
Look at this thing. Based on a blockbuster movie, blessed by none other than Steven Spielberg, and had more marketing money pumped into it than any other game.
And still it failed?
Miserably. You can still see the markdown stickers on the game, Nilsson said, pointing to the tiny stickers showing its various price points. It went from $49.95 to $34.95, then ouch! $12.99, $3.99, and finally, I became a proud owner of the worst video game ever at $1.99.
You really know this business, don't you?
On occasion.
Maybe you should be the one in charge.
Nilsson waved him off.
Oh, stop it. We both know that you're going to turn this company around.
I am?
Nilsson looked at him strangely, as if he were genuinely surprised that Kalinske had no idea that this was going to happen.
Never been more sure of anything in my life.
Truly. Kalinske graciously nodded, and then the two of them sat in Nilsson's office for about an hour, talking about everything from video games and toys to their families and sports. As Kalinske spoke with Nilsson, the company started to feel more like a home. This was his opportunity, and he would find a way to make it work.
I think you're right, Al,
Kalinske said, sitting up. I think that things might actually work out pretty nice.
Fantastic, Nilsson replied. Then I shall eagerly await the next senior staff meeting to see what you've got cooked up.
Kalinske looked across the long table, sizing up his troops. He felt ready to shoulder the responsibilities as president and CEO, ready to turn these guys into his guys, and ready to lead them into battle. In a couple of months, he would go to Japan to meet with the board of directors, outline everything he had learned, and propose the changes that needed to be made to turn Sega into a household name. In the meantime, however, there was only one thing on his mind. Distribution. If distribution was the lifeblood of a company, then Sega had just undergone a blood transfusion. In 1988, when Sega's Master System proved unable to make a dent in NES sales, Sega had struck a deal with the toy manufacturer Tonka to allow them to handle distribution. But despite the weight that Tonka's name carried in the toy world, the company had no idea how to market and sell video games. If the Master System wasn't already dead in the United States, Tonka's failed attempts at distribution fired the final shots. Nakayama blamed Tonka for much of the Master System failures and wouldn't allow such a thing to transpire again.
As a result, Paul Ryo had worked tirelessly to unwind the deal with Tonka so that Sega of America would be solely responsible for their own distribution. In Nakayama's eyes, nothing should hold back the company now. Kalinske, however, was savvy enough to know that many obstacles stood in his way. Lack of brand identity, poor sales history, and most important, Nintendo's unbending grip over the retailers. The fact is, you can't sell something if there's no place for anyone to buy it. Kalinske looked at his employees, who likely had to try their best to think of any response besides, well, yeah, and duh. Yes, I know, it's a pretty obvious concept. But unfortunately, that's our biggest problem at the moment. Kalinske pointed to a map on the wall, indicating which retailers were carrying the Genesis and in which regions the game systems were available. We need to convince more stores to jump on the bandwagon. I know, easier said than done. But I think instead of approaching each of them piecemeal, we're better off using a top-down approach. If we sign up the big boys, the rest will fall into line. What exactly did you have in mind? Nilsson asked. Kalinske narrowed his eyes and answered, Walmart. Getting the Genesis into Walmart wasn't as easy as sending them a free system and letting them see how much better it was than the Nintendo, though Kalinske believed it should have worked like this. Unfortunately, Walmart sold Nintendo products, and they didn't just sell, they flew off the shelves. Nintendo single-handedly accounted for about 10% of Walmart's profits, and the giant retailer felt an obligation to keep the game maker happy. Kalinske, however, was willing to rock the boat.
Maybe it is best to look elsewhere first, Toyota suggested. Take some time.
Time is a luxury we don't have, Kalinske explained. Nintendo had recently announced plans to release their 16-bit machine, the Super Famicom, in Japan later that year, which meant it would probably hit America 1 year later. Sega's days had always felt numbered, but with this recent news, the end felt even nearer. Not with the Super Famicom knocking on our door. Can someone tell me where Katz was with Walmart?
Ryo explained that Katz had made a trip down to Walmart headquarters in Bentonville, Arkansas, to pitch them on Sega, and said that things went okay. Kalinske nodded. In his mind, okay was the worst possible result. Okay was worse than bad. At least bad was memorable.
Well then, Kalinske said, I think it's time that I go back down and show them that Sega is no longer in the business of being okay. The team vigorously prepared for weeks, leading to a combination of stress, brainstorming, and hijinks that, when laminated by Kalinske's perpetual sheen of professionalism, created a dare-to-be-bold corporate culture. At some point, Sega started to feel less like the American outpost of a Japanese company, and more like the cast of an exciting new Broadway musical with defined roles, a choreography of ideas, and ensemble numbers that brought everyone together. The pieces all seemed to be in place, and with the curtain now rising, it was finally showtime.
Chapter 7. Postcards from Arkansas. Walmart headquarters felt like a military compound during peacetime. It was huge, impressively segmented, and delivered the impression that things were not nearly as calm as they seemed. Kalinske entered the complex and was escorted into the office of Walmart's electronics merchant, a man whose every move called to mind the word veteran. The men shook hands, enjoyed some small talk about college football, and eventually meandered toward the conversation that had brought Kalinske here.
How much do you know about video games? Kalinske asked.
Pretty much just whatever Nintendo tells me, the electronics merchant replied.
Well then, allow me to introduce you to the future, Kalinske said, and presented his Sega gadgets along with the product analysis reports and market data that his ragtag team had worked so hard to prepare. He leaned forward, dropped his businessman persona, and spoke in a just-between-us tone.
I understand that Walmart feels an obligation to keep Nintendo happy. I get it. But this isn't a Tengen situation.
Kalinske was referring to Tengen, a video game publisher and developer created by Atari Games. Tengen owned the rights to most of Atari's popular games from the early 1980s, and wanted to license some of the company's more popular titles for the NES.
Hideyuki Nakajima, Tengen's manager, approached Nintendo to work out the details, but he quickly found out that there was nothing to be worked out. Nintendo had a standard licensing agreement that dictated the same terms for all of its licensees. If Tengen wanted their games on the NES, they'd have to sign a very one-sided contract with Nintendo that would prohibit them from releasing their game on any other console and compel them to give Nintendo 30% of their revenue as a royalty. It also stipulated that they'd have to buy physical cartridges directly from Nintendo, which was not only expensive, about $10 each, but often highly frustrating, as it gave Nintendo the leverage to pick and choose which orders to fill. Nakajima thought this was absurd. So in 1986, he arranged for a special meeting with Nintendo of America's president Minoru Arakawa and senior vice president Howard Lincoln to discuss renegotiating these standard terms for what he believed was an exceptional situation. Nakajima kindly reminded Nintendo that Atari, Tengen's parent company, had essentially created the video game industry and deserved some special privileges, particularly the ability to publish more than the 5 titles per year that Nintendo's standard agreement specified. But Arakawa and Lincoln stood their ground and reiterated that no special treatment would be offered. After thinking over the terms of the deal, Nakajima resiliently decided to find a way around this lousy licensing agreement. So he had Tengen engineers begin by trying to find a way around the security device inside the NES. Nintendo's console had a lockout chip containing a protocol called 10NES programming, which detected unlicensed cartridges and prevented them from working. Tengen engineers tried everything to break this code, even chemically peeling layers from the NES chips to allow for microscopic examination. Yet, despite these efforts, Tengen was unable to crack the code, and in 1987, it signed a contract with Nintendo. But after releasing a slew of successful games like Pac-Man and RBI Baseball, Nakajima was infuriated by how much Nintendo's royalty cut into his company's profit margins. He rationalized that the only way to get around the lockout chip was to figure out exactly what made up its 10NES programming. He needed to obtain a copy, but there were only 2 places where this code could be found: Nintendo headquarters and the U.S. Copyright Office. Since breaking into Nintendo was impossible, Tengen would approach the U.S. Copyright Office and claim that they were filing a copyright infringement suit against Nintendo. Despite this being entirely fictional, they went the whole 9 yards to make it appear true, and even signed an affidavit legally testifying about the accuracy and urgency of this lawsuit. The Copyright Office handed over the code, and Tengen worked backward to create a program called the Rabbit, which could unlock the NES. Now, not only did Tengen possess the ability to produce as many games as they saw fit, but by learning about Nintendo's distribution techniques, through the 3 games they had legally released as third-party licensees, they were equipped to contact the retailers directly. Essentially, Tengen had relegated Nintendo to middleman status, and then cut them out completely. This was a brilliant plan in theory, but in practice, the problem came when Nintendo gave the retailers an ultimatum: us or them. Though Nintendo couldn't legally threaten to stop supplying retailers, they had enough strength to use the power of what if. What if our trucks got lost going to your stores? What if we stopped filling your orders in full? To make this an easy decision, the retailers bit the bullet, got rid of all Tengen products, and wrote off the losses. To further flex their muscle, Nintendo eventually took Tengen to court and got an injunction to prevent them from producing their illegally created games. Nakajima and Tengen had no choice but to bow out of the business, and soon the name Tengen served as nothing but a cautionary tale. Now, as Kalinske sat before Walmart's electronics merchant, he tried to make it perfectly clear that this was an entirely different situation. Sega hadn't done anything illegal, nor had they screwed over Nintendo. They were just a competitor who had the better product. "To be perfectly honest," Kalinske said, "I think carrying our products will boost Nintendo's sales. The money we spend on print and television is only going to help the industry overall, and you and I both know exactly who the industry is." The merchant looked through some of Sega's materials again and smiled. Kalinske scooted up to the edge of his seat. He didn't need a big order, just an order. A single order. That would be enough to motivate his employees, give Sega the credibility it sorely needed, and confirm to Kalinske that maybe he wasn't in completely over his head. Please, just a single order, especially with the Super Famicom coming. A little while ago, I was interested in stocking an electronic handheld game, the electronic merchant explained. A stupid little football game, not even close to anything on the Game Boy. For $15, maybe Mom and Dad buy it for Sonny if he makes all A's or hits the game-winning shot. But then a pal of mine, someone in the same line of work, he passes along a rumor to me. There was a small store struggling to keep up with the big boys. They decided they were going to lower the prices of the NES by 5 cents just so they had some small advantage. Well, they advertised this in the Sunday newspaper, their 5 cent advantage. And another small store sees this and calls Nintendo to let them know. A week goes by. Nintendo sends out the trucks to deliver the product, and lo and behold, there's nothing left for the store with the 5 cent discount. And by sheer coincidence, the guy who passed along the tip gets a bigger allocation than normal. The merchant tapped his fingers on the desk. But like I said, this was just a rumor I heard. It's probably not true. After all, that would be illegal. Kalinske shook his head. Not just illegal. It'd be un-American. The merchant gave a gummy smile. Well, perhaps one day we'll return to a place where the streets are paved with gold and all you need to succeed is a good idea, strong work ethic, and some kind of bootstraps. Or perhaps we'll continue to move in the opposite direction. The merchant pondered this for a second and then stood. Personally, I like the place with golden streets. And believe it or not, I like you, Mr. Kalinske. But my answer is no. I understand, Kalinske said, standing to leave. And I appreciate your ode to better, simpler times. But you know what the sad thing is? The man in your story, the one who tipped off Nintendo? I don't really blame that guy. He was just trying to find an angle. If you ask me, the people really killing this country are the ones who realize the American dream is being crushed, but don't bother to do anything about it. Kalinske thanked the merchant for his time, and then flew back to Sega with a 16-bit chip on his shoulder. Chapter 8. The Birth of an Icon. Back in the office, Kalinske stared at his phone with Walmart on his mind. He knew that he had laid it on pretty thick with the electronics merchant, and wasn't sure whether he ought to call back and apologize. Before he could persuade himself in one direction or another, however, the phone rang. Kalinske quickly answered, so certain that it must be the man on his mind that he even took half a second to try to hide the excitement in his voice. It wasn't Walmart. Of course it wasn't Walmart. The man Kalinske had met with didn't even have his direct line. It was Nakayama, whose ominously chipper voice boomed through the phone.
Tom! How is everything? How are you adjusting?
Nakayama and Kalinske spoke just about every day, but still their conversations often began with this open-ended question.
I had a great meeting with Walmart, Kalinske said. I think they're close.
Nakayama was an intelligent man who understood many of the intricacies of the industry, but he didn't quite grasp the distribution difficulties in the United States.
What is the holdup? He asked.
In Japan, where Nintendo also reigned supreme, Sega had still managed to get their products into all the biggest retailers.
I thought everything would be smooth after we moved on from Tonka. I was told this was the plan, Nakayama stated. But I have not a call to discuss distribution. I am calling with good news.
Wonderful, Kalinske said. Let's hear it.
The new company mascot is ready, and he is sure to be a success.
This is the hedgehog named Mr. Needlemouse?
Ah, you have heard, Nakayama said, surprised. We have made some changes, and his name is now Sonic.
Okay, Kalinske said. Well, when can I see him?
I will send him over now, Nakayama said,
and then barked orders in Japanese to someone on the other end.
He will enter through the fax. I will stay on the line to hear your reaction. You will be very pleased.
Kalinske made his way over to the fax machine as it buzzed and huffed, printing out lines of what would be the company's savior.
My guys here have already begun work on the game engine. They showed me an early version, and it is fast like nothing else.
The fax machine stopped sputtering, and Kalinske picked up the sketch.
Ah,
he said, trying not to sound repulsed. Very interesting. Kalinske stared at the drawing, trying to see in it what Nakayama saw, but it was no use. The hedgehog looked villainous and crude, complete with sharp fangs, a spiked collar, an electric guitar, and a human girlfriend whose cleavage made Barbie's chest look flat.
I assume this is his girlfriend?
Yes,
Nakayama said.
That is Madonna.
Kind of racy, no?
Tom,
Nakayama said inside.
Ah, this is not the reaction I expected.
Kalinske continued to stare at the drawing. Sorry, Nakayama-san. Sometimes it just takes a little while for things to sink in for me, he said, still shocked that this bruiser was supposed to be his messiah. Tell you one thing, though, if Sonic and Mario were alone in an alley, I have no doubt who I'd put my money on. He'd been expecting a Mario killer, but not one that literally looked like a serial killer. Maybe the Sonic could sell in Japan, but in America he belonged inside a nightmare. Kalinske got off the phone with Nakayama and took the fax to Madeline Schroeder's office. I have good news and I have scary news. Which do you want first?
This doesn't sound promising.
He handed her the artwork.
What do you think?
She looked it over.
I think we'll be the first video game company whose core demographic is goths.
Nakayama loves it.
Of course he does, she said. It's so weirdly Japanese. I'm surprised the girlfriend's boobs aren't hanging out of a schoolgirl outfit.
Despite his sour mood, Kalinske laughed. Her name is Madonna.
Of course it is, she said.
What kind of leeway did he say we had? We didn't exactly have a Q&A session. Schroeder put the drawing on the desk. After a long, silent inspection, they both spoke at the same time, saying the exact same thing. Can you fix it?
Schroeder sighed. You know, I expected something pretty terrible.
I mean, the second place winner in the contest was an egg, for God's sake.
This is certainly not ideal, but it's actually not as bad as I was bracing for. We can make this work.
Her optimism was contagious. Great, Kalinske said, standing up. Then let's turn this punk into a global icon.
And how exactly do you propose we begin?
Oh, I know a little place where the icons all hang out together. Why don't we grab Al and go check it out? Kalinske, Schroeder, and Nilsson went on a field trip to Toys R Us to pay a visit to some famous friends. Mickey Mouse, G.I. Joe, He-Man, Mr. Potato Head, and the newly popular and ever-rowdy Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Kalinske walked them through the store, pointing out $1 billion property after another, and explaining what made each character unique, likable, and timeless. There didn't appear to be a single toy in the store that Kalinske was unfamiliar with. He knew which company had developed each toy, why they had done so, and how they had gone about marketing it. There was just no place that Kalinske felt more in his element than inside a toy store. Toy stores were more than just a comfort zone or realm of inspiration to him. They were like a library of cultural mythology. His biggest takeaway from the toy industry had been the importance of story. A toy might just be a piece of plastic, but if you added a compelling narrative and a character mythology, you could transform that piece of plastic into the next big thing. He had proved it with Barbie and with He-Man and the Masters of the Universe. And he was starting to feel more and more confident that he could do it with Sonic as well. They stopped in front of a Mickey and Minnie dollhouse. He's the ultimate friend, Kalinske said. No matter what, Mickey remains upbeat and encouraging. It's like he lives to put a smile on the face of others.
Sounds kind of pathetic if you ask me,
Schroeder said.
I prefer my friends to be a little more selective.
Well, not everyone can be as popular as you, Madeline. There are a lot of kids out there who just want someone to like them. Enter Mickey Mouse. Kalinske continued his tour and stopped in front of a large display of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the most recent plastic sensation.
I've been thinking that these guys embody the tone that we should be trying to strike. Playful but edgy. Cool but no leather jackets, you know what I mean?
Nilsson and Schroeder nodded, taking it all in.
And I've seen a few episodes of the cartoon. They do a great job of establishing the universe.
They passed through the boys' action hero section into the pink and purple world of girls' dolls. Kalinske didn't notice until he was face to face with Bath Time Fun Barbie, dressed up like a mermaid. Schroeder and Nilsson noticed his subtle flinch.
"Don't like running into her, do you?" she asked.
Kalinske rolled the question over.
"It can be a little strange sometimes."
"I'm sure it doesn't help that she's just about everywhere," Nilsson said.
Schroeder could tell that the sight of Barbie really did strike a nerve.
"Would it make you feel any better if I told you she was just a piece of plastic?"
"If only that were true," he said with a sigh.
He glared at the doll and moved on, his mind racing with ideas to try to put Barbie in her place. Day after day, Kalinske, Schroeder, and Nilsson worked to turn this critter into something more than lines on a page. At first, their primary focus was subtraction, removing the fangs, the collar, the guitar, and the girlfriend. Then as he began to look more and more like a lost little hedgehog, they worked to add back some of that attitude, focusing less on gimmicks like a guitar or a girlfriend, and more on his backstory and character. To better understand this speedy blue hedgehog, Kalinske had Schroeder write a 13-page Bible that detailed the who, what, where, when, and why of his personality. He had grown up in Nebraska, lost his father at a young age, trained hard to develop world-class speed, and befriended a brilliant scientist who acted as a father figure until an experiment gone awry turned him into an evil villain. Eventually, the creative forces at Sega of America got to the point where they no longer felt like they were making up the hedgehog story on the fly, but actually learning more about a character who truly existed. As they continued to redefine this character from a marketing standpoint, the designers and engineers at Sega of Japan were busy working on a game like no other, in which the hedgehog would star. During this time, Nilsson did what he was often known to do and took things further by rechristening him Sonic the Hedgehog, with his middle name literally being The, on the reasoning that it would make a cool story one day. Sonic wouldn't just become the face of the company, but would also represent their spirit. The tiny underdog moved with manic speed, and no matter what obstacles stood in his way, he never ever stopped going. Sonic embodied not only the spirit of Sega of America's employees, but also the cultural zeitgeist of the early 90s. He had captured Kurt Cobain's whatever attitude, Michael Jordan's graceful arrogance, and Bill Clinton's get-it-done demeanor. When the newly refined hedgehog was ready, Kalinske called up Nakayama.
"We made some changes. I want you to take a look."
"Okay," Nakayama said. "I will call you back."
"No, I'd like to stay on the line and hear your reaction," Kalinske said as he faxed over a copy of Sega of America's revised hedgehog. Nakayama chuckled, but his good mood quickly devolved into a cold neutrality.
"Oh," he said. "This is not even the same hedgehog that we gave you. Where is his lady friend? And those sharp teeth of his?"
"This is not the reaction I was expecting," Kalinske said, echoing not only Nakayama's earlier words, but also his distinctly disappointed tone. Nakayama thought for a moment. He was a man who chose his words wisely, so it was significant whenever he took an extra moment to do so.
"It doesn't matter what I think. It only matters what will sell."
But over the following days, tempers at Sega of Japan began to flare. The game designers believed they should be in charge of every aspect of Sonic. In normal circumstances, this would likely be the case. But since the character of Sonic had initially been created for the goal of success in the United States, Sega of America believed that they knew best when it came to the tastes and preferences of their audience. Days later, Nakayama called Kalinske back, sounding less open-minded.
"My people do not like what you have done to their creation. It no longer resembles what they had in mind. We must revert to the original.
Kalinske realized for the first time that despite being under the same umbrella, Sega was essentially two companies. Sega of Japan, SOJ, and Sega of America, SOA. It didn't matter to SOJ that the new Hedgehog might be better. All that mattered to them was that it wasn't theirs. Although the friction between parent company and subsidiary was subtle, it certainly did exist, and was real in a way that Sergeant Kabuki Man was not. Kalinske knew that this was the moment that could make or break the company. He had to put it all on the line and urge Nakayama to reconsider.
"I've been in the video game business for about 5 minutes," he began, "but I've been in the toy business for over 20 years. You know what the toy business really is? It's not about size, shape, color, or price. It's about character. You want to play with characters you like. You want to become a part of their world and let them become a part of yours," Kalinske said, overwhelmed with passion. "I can only speak for myself, but there's not a character out there that I'd rather spend some time with than our new Sonic the Hedgehog. And if I feel this way, I think there are a lot of others who will feel exactly the same."
Kalinske stopped and took a deep breath. He thought for a moment about reminding Nakayama about his promise to let Kalinske do things his way, and he also considered suggesting they conduct some market tests to see which hedgehog was more popular. But at the end of the day, none of that mattered. This was about a vision, and if Nakayama couldn't see that, then he didn't deserve Sonic. Nakayama finally broke the silence.
"Tom, maybe I agree. But you must understand that there are people here of premium integrity who think differently."
"I understand," Kalinske replied. "So how about we try and change their minds?"
To share Sega of America's vision for Sonic, Schroeder was sent to Japan with the unenviable task of convincing the programmers that although they may know how to develop great games, she and her colleagues knew how to develop great characters. This fateful meeting at SOJ began friendly enough, but when it became clear that Schroeder wasn't interested in revising her vision, tempers began to flare. As a compromise, they suggested that each faction of the company simply have their own Sonic. "You use your Sonic, and we'll use ours." To support this multi-Sonic worldview, they cited how Mickey Mouse wasn't exactly the same all over the world. First off, Schroeder thought, "I don't even think that's true." And secondly, even if Mickey does get localized in certain regions, she felt fairly confident that there wasn't a territory in the world where Mickey had fangs, or Minnie had double D's. Thirdly, and most important, she didn't want two Sonics. This wasn't about Sega of America getting their way, but about creating something immortal that existed in the world's collective imagination. And to do that, there could be no S-O-A-onic and S-O-J-onic. Schroeder tried to make this point, but soon enough, everyone had left the room. Although this impromptu boycott seemed to point toward a Sonic schism, whatever she had said in Japan appeared to have done the trick. When Kalinske next spoke with Nakayama, he and his team were given the green light to proceed as they saw fit. With this mandate, Sonic sprinted toward the finish line, hoping to one day race past Mario and declare war on Nintendo. But in the coming months, those David vs. Goliath dreams were too often dashed by skirmishes between Sega of America and Sega of Japan. This cultural clash would lead to a standoff, in which every decision, big or small, escalated into a battle of pride, principle, or sometimes just pure pettiness. This growing divide would be hard on everyone, but it would undoubtedly be hardest on Shinobu Toyota, the liaison between the two factions. If Schroeder fought for a change and Naka fought against it, it was Toyota who was thrust in the middle and played the role of peacemaker. Kalinske knew that when it comes to war, everyone ultimately has to pick a side. And in the process of watching Toyota constantly trying to broker peace between SOA and SOJ, he finally saw this man's true colors. Toyota looked like a Japanese man and sounded like a Japanese man, but when push came to shove, he remained loyal to SOA. It was the small things that Kalinske noticed. The way he translated fighting words into diplomatic terms. The way he might claim Nakayama had approved something that he'd never even seen. Most important were the subtle ways he moved the emotional chess pieces to get what SOA wanted, for example, by doing something like adding a ridiculous character detail and then gaining leverage over SOJ by offering to remove it. But before any of those unnecessary battles in the Sonic Wars would be fought, Kalinske was informed about a more pressing conflict. Sega's negotiations with Electronic Arts. "What negotiations?" Kalinske asked.
"I'm sure I must have mentioned this earlier,"